part 6 of 9 from set number 3014, The Great Magicians, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stephen Heller entitled Albert Pike, Masonic Magus.
And with that, I shall proceed now with this evening's topic, which is on a figure probably better known to historians and Freemasons and Masonic historians than to others, but perhaps will be better known by the time we finish, namely Albert Pike, General Albert Pike. In order to place Albert Pike and his contribution into proper context, we may wish to say something about the kind of institution that Freemasonry is, and its possible origins and meanings, and then just a little bit about Freemasonry itself, and then we will proceed to Albert Pike. It has been noted by cultural anthropologists, mythologists, and similar folk. In fact, I believe this particular idea has been most extensively explored by Mircea Eliade and some others, that what might be called the alternative mystical tradition from really very ancient, indeed prehistoric times on, has among its several features that it envisions spiritual progress as being of an initiatory nature. What we mean by this is that probably beginning with the ancient shamans, it has been discovered that certain steps or leaps or stages of the development of interior visionary and mystical consciousness are taken by individuals in a manner that one might refer to these stages and steps as initiations. Initially, these are probably pretty much of a subjective nature, such as, let's say, a shaman walks out into the forest, sort of responding to a internal call, and there undergoes various extraordinary internal experiences, and then comes out a different person than when he went in. So much so that, let's say, the community, the village or settlement or whatever it may be where he's living, all notice that he is now a shaman. And he may undergo such initiatory experiences several times in his, and indeed there are shamanesses as well in his or her life. Later on, these sorts of steps of the initiatory change of consciousness in many cases become formalized and perhaps one might even say institutionalized. So that when we come to certain practices of the ancient Egyptians, and most certainly the ancient Greeks, who are the great example in this regard, we have mystery institutions. And in these mystery institutions, initiations are conferred on the persons who come there for that purpose. And once the people go through these initiatory procedures, again, they have internally changed to a marked degree. It has been said by a number of outstanding figures of the ancient world, one person who comes to mind is that otherwise not terribly effusive old sourpuss lawyer Marcus Tullius Cicero, and politician. You know, Cicero means something like a garbanzo bean, a chickpea, isn't it? That's really what it means. That was his name. That these, let's say, the Eleusinian mysteries, who were sort of the pinnacle of these institutions in ancient Greece, was the greatest ennobling influence of culture in the ancient world. Someone else reported, for instance, that everyone who had gone through the Eleusinian mystery system had totally lost the fear of death thereafter, which I think is a momentous achievement. In any event, as time went on, of course, with the newly dominant religion of Christianity in the Mediterranean area and in Europe, the old mystery institutions went by the wayside. But let's say the reality of initiatory changes of consciousness didn't go away, because human consciousness didn't go away. When certain institutions or practices are rooted in the nature of human consciousness and its changes, then of course they will not go away, because they have an innate relationship to this important part of human nature. So let's say there have been again and again activities, institutions in various places which practice initiations and which therefore supplied a need of the transformation of consciousness. Of course, the dominant influence for a very long time in Europe and over the Mediterranean was not friendly towards such activities, because religion often has a tendency to declare that it alone is qualified to deal with the consciousness of people in its own way, and that everybody else who tries something of that sort is a heretic, is a schismatic, or a lunatic. And perhaps all three of these together. And so both in Christendom and in Islam, these sorts of activities were kept rather underground, although they did come forth. The Sufi orders, which emerged at a certain point in Islamic history, for instance, are very much along this nature. And there were sporadic sort of outbreaks in semi-secrecy, of course, in Christendom as well. Now, it is my contention, and I think it has a considerable amount of likelihood, of plausibility, that Freemasonry is one of the principal heirs, and indeed, we might say, embodiments of this initiatory tradition. As far as secular history is able to establish, Freemasonry, at least as an outwardly active organization, started somewhere in the early 18th century, although there is sort of one piece, maybe there are more by now, I don't know, there's sort of one piece of seemingly serious evidence indicating that it existed in the century prior to that, in the 17th century, in the 1600s, because there's a redoubtable English gentleman, a sort of a man of many talents and activities, and certainly a most interesting and curious name, Mr. Elias Ashmole, or rather Master Elias Ashmole, probably, who in his writings had stated the date and the place of when he was made a Mason. And that was in the 1600s. So that's the only one that we know of, but apparently there was something going on at that time. Now, very much like the mystery institutions of antiquity, Freemasonry has a kind of a central mythos. And this is the mythos, as we might expect, not of an ancient god or goddess, as might have been the case, let's say, with the Dionysian and the Eleusinian and the Orphic mysteries, but rather of an obscure biblical figure. And this obscure biblical figure is looked upon as a builder who is involved in the building of the Temple of Solomon, and who in the course of his activities is murdered, and who then is seen in a kind of resurrectional situation, rising from the dead. And this person is known by the name of Hiram Abiff. And what in the central practice, and this is the central mythos of the central practice of the initiations of Freemasonry, so there are several steps, there are three steps in the basic Masonic Lodge, the so-called Blue Lodge, because the various implements are of the blue color. The final initiation in the third degree, which has sort of taken on, in a colloquial language, a kind of humorous notion that I'm going to give you the third degree, you know, or make you ride the goat, and assure you the rather ill-smelling and otherwise unpleasant animals called goats have not really been admitted into Masonic lodges. You know, these are all kind of jokes that have been made. But let's say this last and final degree is an initiatory activity wherein the individual, let's say, undergoes the death and resurrection of Hiram Abiff. Incidentally, I do dearly hope that I am not transgressing and being clandestine in saying this, because you can really find this much and more information in innumerable books that are being tossed around in the bookstores. So this is not a secret, you know. In fact, if someone were to ask me, you know, what are the secrets, what is the real secret of any initiatory body that really does something, including Masonry, I would say the secret is what you experience when you undergo these rites, you know. An intellectual, a mental idea or concept or story or a bunch of words or things or signs, you know, they are not really secret. What is secret is what happens to you, you know. And if nothing happened to you or you're not aware of it, well, I guess you missed the secret. See? That's it. In any event, Freemasonry, which then in the course of its history, after, let's say, in building on this basic structure of the central three initiations and their mythos, added the so-called higher degrees, with additional symbolism, became a very important institution in Europe and ultimately in the United States. The reasons for the popularity of Freemasonry were manifold, and I'm sure that I could not discover or enumerate them all. But among them was certainly, let's say, the inner drive and desire of the human soul for expansion and change of consciousness, in this case, as in many others, carried on in an initiatory manner, and the relative lack of modalities in the 18th century, in the 19th century primarily, that would supply that particular need. Because on the religious side, large portions of Europe, Western and Northern Europe, had become Protestant. And the Protestant churches reveled in doing away with the often elaborate symbolism of the Catholic Church and of its seven sacraments, which are, according to very reputable scholarship, a kind of initiatory system manqué. Manqué because, of course, the anti-Gnostic and anti-Hermetic and sort of anti-everything church fathers, you know, would not admit that a Christianity practiced initiations like those despicable pagans. And therefore they found other explanations, sort of covering up their system, but of course it was there. So that, let's say, it supplied a good deal of that particular inner need of the psyche of people. But when all of this was taken away and sort of erased, along with just about every mysticism, a big vacuum appeared in the psyche of people, of the peoples of, say, Germany, the Scandinavians, England, Holland, which maybe wasn't Holland yet, not only maybe, but certainly, and so forth. So that certainly was one important reason. The other one was, let's say, semi-political, and Protestantism did not play such a big role in it, because, for instance, France, which became a very, very important repository of Freemasonry, in France, the Catholic Church was reduced in numbers and in influence by way of political process. It wasn't Protestants who reduced Catholicism, but the French Revolution and the secular and quasi-revolutionary governments thereafter. So once again, there was a need. A need for initiatory experience, which was not tainted by what many Frenchmen by then would have considered the unfortunate features, especially politically, of the Catholic Church. So that made Masonry quite popular in France, and it's interesting to note that unlike in German, unlike in English, the name for Masonry and for Masons in France was not Freemasonry, but rather Franc-Masonerie, F-R-A-N-C, which means Frank, the Frankish Masons. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In Hungarian too, it's Freemasons, Szabad Kőműves. But, you know, the French always have to be different. I mean, that's just the way it is. In any event, you know, that is sort of, in great outline form, the basic historical developmental scheme of Masonry, without getting involved in too many dates and too many names and things like that at this point, which, if you don't know them already, you are likely to forget before you walk out of here anyway. At least that's, even though I was, I never had but the best grade in history, that was my really greatest favorite. Still, I was never very good at memorizing dates, you know, because they are figures. I can't remember, and I don't want to remember phone numbers for the same reason. And social security numbers and things like that, were resistance against that, you know, cluttering my mind with figures. Very annoying. In any event, now, what we need to keep in mind, however, and that's very germane to our subject, that something entered the picture in the 18th century and then into the 19th century that complicated matters. And what was that? That was what was called the Enlightenment. Enlightenment. Well, the Enlightenment, of course, was an intellectual movement led by what in those days were called the philosophers, les philosophes, which was a very different thing from a philosophy professor at UCLA today, you know, or something like that. But the people like Voltaire and Rousseau and Diderot and D'Alembert and Leibniz and Goethe even, you know, and others, were people who had a very universal scope of their vision and who were pretty much also agreed upon the need to reduce the influence of organized religion, as it's called nowadays, which I'm always a little bit suspicious of, because, you know, who wants a disorganized religion? But anyway, you know, primarily the Catholic Church. And these folk, not all of them, but many of them, were also quite enthusiastic Freemasons, led by Voltaire, It's even known as to which lodge he belonged to in Paris, and in fact at his Masonic funeral, a fellow Mason from the, well, probably still the American colonies by the name of Dr. Benjamin Franklin was present, you know. So there was a great deal of this sort of thing going on. However, as C.G. Jung says in his little poetic mystical treatise, The Seven Sermons to the Dead, he says, to every blessing of God the Son, S-U-N, the devil adds his curse, which can be expressed less politically, that, you know, everything casts a shadow and doesn't stay as good as it was in the beginning. The shadow of the Enlightenment was the coming of rationalism, which was a nice weapon, a nice sword to use against the Catholic Church for a while, because it said, look, guys, you know, your dogmas don't make any sense. You know, you're just a bunch of superstitious so-and-sos. But what, of course, rationalism eventually did, that it reduced and did away with insight by way of symbolism, and it did away with the alternative forms of spirituality as well as with the organized religion as such. And so while Voltaire could still be an esotericist, actually, I have a whole book that is says the title is something like the substance of Voltaire's esoteric thought, and it's really true. And others like Goethe practiced alchemy, actual physical alchemy and things of that sort. You know, these people were what you would consider weird, you know. But as time went on, the Enlightenment took on a more and more prosaic, rationalistic, and even materialistic format and contours, which was very, very unfortunate. Now, to come a little closer now to our subject, the most prominent and beautiful product of the Enlightenment was the United States of America. You know, if you walk around in Washington, D.C., and you go to especially that absolutely sublimely wonderful monument, which is dedicated to Jefferson, the Jefferson Monument, or the obelisk dedicated to the first President Washington. And if you are the slightest bit sensitive to those things, you know, you get a feeling of the Enlightenment. And it's sublimely beautiful and optimistic and inwardly transfigurative, that really humanity in this world can go somewhere, that we are not miserable sinners, but that in us really dwells the light of the stars, and that we can be free, and we can discover things, and we can be somebody, you know. Somehow, as time went on, of course, that reduced somewhat also. But right among the founders of the American Republic, and then in fairly short order among a large number of people in all walks of life, there came an institution, no doubt connected with and also born of the Enlightenment, which had a plethora of symbols, a plethora of rituals, and which was indeed none other than Freemasonry. And so, let's say it once again, the need for ritual with spiritual undertones, the need for symbolic transformation, and indeed the need for, let's say, the companionship of the like-minded, the fraternity of the initiates, was supplied by Freemasonry. And indeed, it must be said that whatever other problems may have arisen, and they certainly did arise, the rationalistic and kind of materialistic sub-aspects of the Enlightenment did not really infiltrate these circles in the United States and did not infiltrate Freemasonry. But, let's say, Freemasonry was there, but its effect on people, it would seem to me, until the mid-19th century, was, let's say, largely sort of on the unconscious and on the preconscious level, which I'm sure is true of a lot of initiates in Eleusis or elsewhere. In other words, the practice was there, but the kind of more profound esoteric theory which might have amplified this practice and explained much of it in a very deep manner wasn't really there. Or was there sporadically and in a minor fashion? It took until the middle sort of and the latter part of the 19th century that a truly prophetic figure arose in America who set the task to himself to fully expound the esoteric substance and the esoteric background of Freemasonry to the American Masons. One man, and that man was General Albert Pike. So now we need to take a little look at General Pike's biography and then certainly also on what he really stood for and what he really did. Now, Pike came to Masonry and to America, really. I mean, he didn't come to America, he was born here, at a time when a great assault was taking place on Freemasonry, which came to equal and perhaps even surpass the assaults that were visited upon Freemasonry in Europe largely as the result of the propaganda of the Catholic Church, because already in the 18th century the first papal bull was issued against Freemasonry. And you know, it's a curious term which really comes from the Latin bulla, but some people maybe here might consider that sometimes it really denotes the content of such a document. A lot of bull. So, you know, there were problems in Europe, but there definitely were problems in the first half of the 19th century in United States. Much of this assault, which resulted in a substantial decline of the American Masonic movement, had its origins in an obscure scandal known as the Morgan Affair. A somewhat disreputable person named William Morgan, who was either a Mason or an infiltrator of Masonic lodges, you know, a Cowan or intruder, because Cuon means a dog, and you know, the dogs come and sniff around. So initiatory orders call sort of individuals who are nosers, who come around, dogs. In any event, he may have been something like that. In New York State, this man was killed, he was murdered. And his death was ascribed to several members of the Masonic Lodge in Batavia, New York. Whether the Masons really did Mr. Morgan in or not will probably never be known, but it certainly was played up that they did. The reason, of course, having been that Morgan became angry at a particular Masonic Lodge, and he threatened to publish an expose of secret Masonic rituals, which angered the local Masons greatly, although, of course, if they had been truly well informed about the literature, they would have known that there were several books circulating already which exposed all the Masonic secret rituals, you know. Because, as I say, those things can never be kept secret. They tried to prosecute Mr. Morgan on unrelated charges, and later his body was found lifeless, and the Masons were accused of the murder. Actually, Mr. Morgan seemed to have been pretty much of a sleazy and nasty character, But you know who was a much more interesting character, who obviously could not have been a Mason, was his wife. His wife had a most interesting story. After her husband was dead, this lady came to join the fledgling Mormon movement. And she became the first plural wife of the Mormon prophet Joseph Smith, to be followed, of course, by quite a few others, because otherwise they wouldn't have been all that plural. I mean, he had a singular wife, and quite singular she was, Emma, but then came the plural wives, and the first of those plural wives was the widowed Mrs. Morgan. She was also a poet, and she wrote the majority of the hymns that to this day are sung in the Church of the Latter-day Saints. So quite an astonishing lady, but apparently after the death of her plural husband, Joseph Smith, she became disaffected with the Mormon movement as well, and she ended her days as a Roman Catholic nun. Now, if that's not an interesting progression from wife and widow of a Mason to plural wife of the Mormon prophet to Catholic nun, I don't know what is. So I don't know, Spielberg or somebody should become aware of this, but of course the Mormons would probably prevent him from making a movie out of her life. But that was the widow of Mr. Morgan. Now, from the 1820s through the 1840s, there was an official political party, just like the Republican and Democratic parties today, an official political party in the United States called the Anti-Masonic Party, which existed for the sole purpose of trying to eliminate Freemasonry in the U.S. The damage done to the Masonic order was very extensive. Now, it was in the immediate wake of this greatest ever assault on Masonry in this country that there appeared on the horizon of Freemasonry a man named Albert Pike. The late Manly P. Hall, the sage of Los Angeles, and of course himself, by the time of his death, the 33rd degree Mason, wrote about Albert Pike as follows, and I'll be quoting Mr. Hall again. Albert Pike was the great American Freemason. He found the organization in a log cabin and left it in a palace. He took all its numerous vicissitudes upon himself and labored unceasingly through a long and industrious life for the perfection of Masonic ideals. This wrote Mr. Hall, Manly Hall. Pike's biography holds much interest, but must be reduced here to its bare essentials. He was born in Boston, Massachusetts in 1809, so within the first decade of the 19th century. From humble working class background, he grew up to become a true youthful genius. At the age when others were still attending high or preparatory school, he entered Harvard. In view of the high tuition, he conceived of a scheme which shows that he wasn't a bad businessman either, but, you know, often schemes don't really work out. He conceived a scheme whereby he would master the curriculum of the first 2 years of Harvard on his own, privately, and then enter at the junior year level. He hoped to thus avoid paying the first 2 years' tuition, which was considerable. But his hopes were dashed by the rather stern and greedy officials of Harvard, who didn't like to give anything away free. They said, "We will admit you to the junior level as a third-year student," but they also informed him that he would still be required the full tuition of the 2 preceding years. Even though he had been teaching full-time at local schools all along, he could not come up with the considerable amount of money. Thus he left Harvard and became a part-time poet and essayist and journalist for several years. Ironically, quite a few years later, in 1859, after his fame was established as a scholarly champion, in this case of the American Indian tribes, That's when Harvard conferred an honorary degree upon him, which he graciously accepted. He eventually left New England, and after spending some time in New Mexico, he finally settled in Little Rock, Arkansas, where he prepared himself by studying law and was granted a law license by the judiciary of the state of Arkansas. It was in Little Rock that he became involved with Freemasonry, which became the passionate and sacred commitment of his entire life. Between 1850 and 1859, he rose through all the degrees of both the York and the Scottish Rites of Freemasonry, and also served the term as worshipful master of a lodge in Little Rock. Now, for the information of those who may not know this, you know, the higher degrees of Freemasonry, that is the degrees beyond the first three degrees of the Blue Lodge, which are the basic and which everyone has to go through, sort of bifurcate into two lines of initiatory sequence. One of these is called the York Rite, no doubt named originally after the British city and area of York. And the other one is the Scottish Rite. And nowadays, and probably even then, really ambitious Masons, which is most of them, take both of them in succession. And the highest degree of the York Rite is a Knight Templar degree, interestingly enough. And then the Scottish Rite has the 33 degrees, the highest of 33rd, which is conferred in an honorary capacity. So he went through both of these at that period of time. In 1859, he was elected by the Supreme Council to the highest office in Scottish Rite Freemasonry, namely that of Most Puissant Sovereign Grand Commander, which office he held for 32 years until his death. Now, the Civil War caught up with Albert Pike in Arkansas. Though by birth and upbringing a New England Yankee, he was now a resident of Arkansas for 28 years and captain in the Arkansas Home Guard. He thus cast his lot with the Confederacy. For years he had pursued the study of languages and culture of several Indian tribes. He was an incredible linguist. And he now became the chief negotiator of the Confederacy with these tribes. He managed to persuade six major tribes to join the cause of the Confederacy. Now that's a lot of braves or brave soldiers. He was promoted to Brigadier General and put in charge of the Department of Indian Territory of the Confederacy. After some vicissitudes at the end of the Civil War, of course, he was captured by the Union, and as a prominent person and general, he almost suffered a bad fate. But I think not entirely without the aid and support of many good Freemasons in the ranks of the Union and of the Washington government, he was granted a pardon in 1868, and where he was now totally exonerated, and he could settle in Washington, D.C., eventually as the Grand Commander of the Scottish Rite Masons. Now, it was now that his status as what I called a Masonic Magus became apparent. He rewrote the Scottish Rite degrees, giving invariably mystical and arcane interpretations to the various degrees. In 1871, his chief work, Morals and Dogma of the Ancient and Accepted Rite of Freemasonry, was published, which was followed by several works of a magico-religious nature, such as translations of the Rig Veda, the Friends of Indra, and many others, predominantly about esoteric Hinduism and Zoroastrianism. In other words, he wrote the interpretation of the degrees, many of them first, then he wrote Morals and Dogma, which has more. And then he had a lot of this, what nowadays we would call maybe sort of esoteric comparative religious treatises thereafter. On April 2nd, 1891, he died at his Scottish Rite headquarters in Washington, D.C., where he lived for many years. He was buried and memorialized both by Masonic rites, which a sort of the allusion to it in one of his biographical books sort of appealed to me. Apparently the Freemasons there rented or secured a congregational church, and there was his Masonic memorial. At night, with all the walls covered in black and with hundreds of candles surrounding the old gentleman's coffin. I like things like that. And then subsequently his official funeral conducted by the Episcopal Church. His life-size statue stands in Washington, D.C. on Judiciary Square on Indiana Avenue, Northwest. He had been an avid scholar all his life. As an example, he taught himself Sanskrit at the age of 70, thereby putting the time-honored statement that you can't teach an old dog new tricks to shame. This, in addition to his knowledge of Hebrew, Greek, Latin, Syriac, Persian, and several American Indian languages. Now, what was Pike's chief accomplishment? Briefly, one might say that he revealed the esoteric heart of Freemasonry as this has been revealed to him by both scholarship and intuition. Once again, his fellow Mason and fellow esotericist, Manly Palmer Hall, expressed this in the following manner, and this is from a magnificent essay that Mr. Hall published in a collection of his essays called The Phoenix, if you want to look at it at some point. Very, very fine work. This is a fairly long quotation, but it's really worth it. From the foregoing, it is evident that Freemasonry not only accepts Albert Pike as a standard of Masonic excellence, but by the dignity showered upon him gives official recognition to the systems of thought which he inculcated upon the rituals and symbols of the craft. To Albert Pike, Freemasonry was synonymous with scholarship. Having searched as few men have searched into the hazy background of Freemasonic tradition, Pike is undoubtedly the best qualified authority to whom one can turn in the effort to discover the essential elements of Freemasonry. In his interpretation of Masonic symbolism, and you must keep in mind, those of you who are not thus informed, that Freemasonry is a ritual system of symbols par excellence. Very, very great use of symbols. So in the interpretation of Masonic symbolism, Albert Pike naturally turned, as all scholars must ultimately do, to those ancient institutions from which has descended to this age the whole bounty of spiritual good. Nor does Pike hesitate through any false pride to acknowledge the origin of his illumination in the mysteries of Ceres and Persephone at Eleusis, of Isis and Osiris in Egypt, of Attis and Adonis in Syria, of the Druzes of Lebanon and the Druids of Britain, of the persecuted Gnostics and the reviled Kabbalists, as well as a score of others. He found the roots of the great tree which was to grow up through the ages under the name of Freemasonry and spread its branches over the modern world. He who denies this denies Pike, the rituals, and the evident, for the wealth of Freemasonry lies in those traditions with which it is bound to the great cultural systems of antiquity. Members of the craft proudly refer to their brother Pythagoras as an illustrious example of ancient initiation. But do they remember that this, quote, brother was a transcendental magician, possessed of all the supernatural powers which moderns ridicule, and immortalized because of the superlative quality of his erudition. By this, of course, Manly Hall indicates as to how important the esoteric contribution of Pike was to Freemasonry. It was also Manly Hall who, in his noted essay on Pike, indicated the various spiritual schools or doctrines which Pike espoused. They are as follows. Number one, the Kabbalah. Manly P. Hall said early on in his essay about Pike that Pike's principal source for Kabbalah was Eliphas Levi, and his works, particularly Transcendental Magic. In very recent times, there came to be published a book of very thorough research, which is entitled Eliphas Levi and the Kabbalah, and which contains a large portion, a large chapter, on the influence of Eliphas Levi on Albert Pike, and through that channel on Freemasonry. This book was only published in 2006. It is written by a very interesting gentleman from Texas, Robert L. Uzel, and it was my good fortune back in the late 1990s to have carried on a very intense and indeed at times demanding correspondence with Mr. Uzel and several lengthy phone calls whereby he was attempting to pick my often inadequate brain. But let's say I am very happy that I managed to supply him with some stimulus and also some material, and he gave me a great deal of credit, and he quoted me extensively in his book. But this is, and especially the portion dealing with Eliphas Levi and Pike, is the best research on that subject, detailed research that exists. It was Mr. Zell's doctoral dissertation at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, in 1995, and is now available, and I have received the gift of it, and I'm really, really very happy with that book. Mr. Zell has also pointed out something that might make some people recoil a little bit, and that is that Pike simply copied pages and pages of Eliphas Levi verbatim and put them in his book, Morals and Dogma. Nowadays, this would be called plagiarism. But we need to keep in mind that at that time, that was very frequently done. And all the copyright laws and various other tortuous legal situations regarding writings did not exist. He did it with other authors as well. He actually mentions, if you read the, I think it's foreword or introduction to Morals and Dogma, he owns up to the fact that he had copied verbatim a great many sources which he considered to be authoritative, and that he wished that perhaps he would have copied more because he felt that all of these passages were much better than the ones that he wrote himself. Quite a, you know, humility there. In any event, certainly he was greatly inspired and influenced by Eliphas Levi. Documenting his interest and devotion to the Kabbalah, Pike did that and more. Now the question arises, why Kabbalah? Well, I think that if we refer to various authoritative writings and commentaries on the Kabbalah, and maybe even to a few lectures of mine, then we will find that the Kabbalah is, among its many virtues, has the virtue of acting as a magnificent organizing system of, let's say, esoteric knowledge. It is fabulously systematic and orderly. And as one, and I always quote that, as one Kabbalist said early on in the 20th century, that the Kabbalah is like a great big filing system into which every kind of idea and experience can be placed and will find its proper place. And I have certainly found it such myself, because once you study Kabbalah, sort of the archetype of systematic understanding of esoteric things sinks into your own psyche. It's a tremendous help. So he was very, very laudatory and very fond of Kabbalah, as indeed was Eliphas Levi. That's the great reason for Pike's interest in the Kabbalah. But of course, at the same time, whenever you have a system of this sort, you can also begin to see, let's say, steps of initiatory progression, very similar to the Masonic system of initiatory progression of degrees on the Tree of Life itself. Mm-hmm. Because as, let's say, the practice of pathwork, which is of, you know, considerable historical origin of Kabbalah, points out, one can use the pattern of the Etz Chaim, of the Tree of Life, to lift one's consciousness step by step, and have various experiences in the course of this progression. And this certainly would remind a person of initiatory progress by degrees. So that is certainly another important feature of Kabbalah. The second element, let's say, that Pike came to incorporate in his interpretations and writings is Hermeticism, both in the form of the Corpus Hermeticum and as the magical, mystical worldview. So when Pike referred to matters hermetic, he was not only referring to the Hermetic books, which were rediscovered and translated at the time of the Renaissance, but really also of all of what might be called the Hermetic or hermetically influenced and inspired magico-mystical tradition of practices and theories of the Middle Ages and of the modern era. So he considered this very valuable and, once again, a great source of information. Once again, I need to emphasize the fact that all of these systems that we are talking about now, Kabbalah, Hermeticism, were systems of symbols. And Pike recognized that long before depth psychology, a century before C.G. Jung, that the serious, devoted contemplation of symbols does something to you. Okay? That symbols are doorways into deeper realities and more profound recognitions. You know, the symbols are not just a disguise that stands for something else, but the symbols are, as I think Henri Corbin, the great Sufic scholar and also associate of Carl Jung, said, symbols are the cipher to the mystery. When you understand the cipher, not just intellectually, but inwardly, something happens, something opens up. And so Pike looked at these various ancient symbol systems and said, see what they do? They do what we are trying to do in Freemasonry. They open up your soul, they do something to you, they really initiate you. The third element which he included in his interpretations is our old friend alchemy, which he envisioned as both spiritual or psycho-spiritual, once again, about 100 years before Carl Jung. He pointed out that the philosopher's stone can develop inside of you. That alchemy has to do with the transformation within yourself. But interestingly enough, he also said, oh yes, it also has a physical aspect. If you know how, you can probably make gold, but he didn't make much of it. And he never was a rich man, he never had much money, so I seriously doubted that he made any physical gold, although he believed that it could be done. You see, so there is alchemy, the art of transformation. Again, you know, highly, highly symbolic in nature. The fourth element, which he included in his works, was Platonism, as a philosophical discipline that leads to spiritual illumination. And this also, I think, is of extreme importance, because you need to remember that Platonism, which originally was really used as the great auxiliary philosophy of the Christian Church for quite a long time, was replaced by Aristotelianism, which in turn, by the time Pike was working, was sort of funneled into a new kind of quasi-philosophy of science, and became increasingly rationalistic and materialistic, and really not particularly useful for spiritual purposes. Pike went back to Plato, and he felt that a philosophy should not be just an intellectual discipline. If it does not lead to something spiritual in the soul, then what good is it? Mm-hmm. Very, very much of a true esoteric view and true esoteric understanding. But you see, you need to keep in mind that a lot of people, even though they may, even if they may be attracted to the intellectual aspect of philosophy of various disciplines, once that discipline begins to take them beyond the boundaries of ordinary intellectualism and personalistic notions, and what happens to them? They get scared. They get scared. Why? Because once you are near to the fire, that spiritual fire, well, like the alchemical fire, it's going to make you change. And you know what? Most of us don't want to change. We may talk all we want about wanting to change, but if we really do, we get alarmed. Whatever that change may be, physically, if we put on more of a midriff than we had before, we become alarmed and we run to the exercise salon, you know. I mean, that's just one. But in all kinds of other respects, we really are afraid of that. And so when we touch that deeper nature, which then of necessity imposes certain modifications upon our ordinary psyche, and indeed even our body, that we usually shy away from. Now, that's precisely where in, let's say, initiatory organizations such as Freemasonry come in. And why is that? Because when you undergo these processes within a community of like-minded and like-aspiring people, and when you have the support of the large officers and everybody there, then it is much easier to continue and to move from the intellectual into something deeper. You know, the supportive community, which is the lodge in this case, is of tremendous importance. And if within that supportive community there are meaningful successive rituals and symbols, and all of that is pretty well coordinated, then of course that can be an immense help. This is, incidentally, this principle is what gave rise to the saying in the early church, which has certainly been misinterpreted, I think, and really debased, I think, in a dogmatic fashion later on, like everything does at some point, extra ecclesiam nulla salus. You see, outside of the community, there is no salvation. Well, it's maybe a little overstatement, okay? Because you should never say never and never say always, right? But the fact of the matter is that the support of the community and its procedures is an immense help, because the individual blockages and difficulties that may stand in the way are more easily overcome in that fashion. So the Platonic philosophy, philosophical disciplines, were certainly of great importance in Pike's work. For instance, here is a little quotation from Pike's own writings. The noblest purpose of life and the highest duty of man are to strive incessantly and vigorously to win the mastery in everything of that which in him, in the human, is spiritual and divine over that which is material and sensual. Oh boy, people knew how to write nice sentences in the 19th century, you know, not these runaway sentences that they write now. The fifth element was what might be called the universal gnosis, or theosophia, which is present in all traditions, for which reason he wrote about Jewish Kabbalah, Hindu Vedas and myths, Zoroastrian scriptures, Greek myths, like his contemporary and fellow admirer of Eliphas Levi, the theosophist Madame Blavatsky. He saw the light shining in all traditions and religions and adored it accordingly. Here I need to put in a little caveat, even though I should be going on, saying that, you know, there are two kinds of, well, shall we say, ecumenicity, which is a more recent word. There is an ecumenicity of the lowest common denominator, where you reduce everything to the kind of baby talk of spirituality that almost anyone can identify with, and which, when all is said and done, doesn't really lead anywhere, you know. Oh, well, you know, they all believe in God. Yes, you know, and they all have commandments, yes, you know, and all this sort of thing, which really doesn't amount to a hill of beans from an esoteric point of view, you know. And yet this is what passes for ecumenicity, you know, in the mainstream churches and so forth, you know. Well, you know, all you need to be is a good God-fearing man, and you'll say, okay, or woman. But, you know, again, these things at the lowest possible level. And there is a higher level. And what is that? Which are the mysteries of God, right? And which ultimately lead to the experience of the divine. This is what the esoteric tradition addresses itself to. At the deepest and at the most profound level. See, it's that middle level that divides. Like Madame Blavatsky said, the mind, the slayer of the real. And by mind, she didn't just mean the thinking principle, but sort of the whole ego complex. That is what divides. Oh, no, you know, I'm a Christian. Oh, yeah, I accepted JC as my PS. you know, I'm a real Christian. Nobody else, you know. Not the Catholics, not the Presbyterians, not the Eastern Orthodox, even though they were here a long time before this kind of, before the fundamentalists were here. But, you know, the way they usurp the word Christian could make, you know, every time I think about it, it makes me scream. But thing is, it's bad for your vocal cords. All this sort of thing. And where does that come from? It comes from mind. It comes from the collective egotism. Come all of these divisions. But you know, beyond that, then there is true ecumenicity. That's why I say, talking to a real Sufi is very, very different from talking to a Wahhabi or an Al-Qaeda boy, you know. It's an entirely different thing because there is a communion and a communication at that deeper level. You see, this is the thing that those people in the 19th century, and when we look down on them as old-fashioned, there were people like Blavatsky, people like Eliphas Levi, people like Pike. They understood that. They said, if we all can get deep enough, there is a universal stratum of spiritual truth there, you see. Not just intellectualism, but things to be realized. And there we can really be one and communicate with each other. Pike was definitely of that conviction. Now, in conclusion, it is necessary for us, I think, to ask and answer maybe at least one important question. And here it is. According to Pike, is Freemasonry a discipline of magic, of occultism, or esotericism, or not? The answer is Freemasonry as such is not. Freemasonry is an initiatory system of symbolic practice that has an outer and an inner content. As always, a great many of its initiate members avail themselves of the outer content and only unconsciously or preconsciously intuit some of the inner mystery. You know, as long as, once again, that slaying of the real and that arrogance doesn't enter the picture, that's all right, at least in my estimation. Who am I to tell my Masonic brothers what's all right and what isn't all right, but just theoretically, you know. Even as, according to Elaine Pagels and some others, St. Paul the Apostle, for instance, envisioned for the Christian church a situation where, well, let's say, people whom now we would call the so-called Orthodox and the people of Gnostic orientation could worship together, and there wouldn't have to be a division. So I think that in an initiatory body like Freemasonry, certainly, depending on the inclinations and the abilities, the developed abilities of the members, some will see the process in the procedures in a less explicitly esoteric manner, and others who perhaps see a little bit more deeper will perceive the esoteric side. There is no reason why these could not really coexist. And so many people, probably the majority of Freemasons in the various countries, practice the brotherhood of the craft, and they discern the inner light in the symbols and mythic themes and images of their rituals, because as certainly modern depth psychology has pointed out, if you are really allow the symbols that you are dealing with to enter your consciousness, they will help to change you in a proper fashion, they will help to transform you, whether you can intellectually explain it or not. Okay? This is the way that sort of thing works. But of course, if these effects of the symbols and the rituals can also be amplified by mental means, then the process is thereby very greatly enriched. And it is that enriching that Pike was trying to promote. And he found sources whereby that could be enriched. Because of course there are those who, like Pike, have seen the inner light pouring through the gateways of their symbol system, who are able to participate in depth in that system, and these are the people with an esoteric vision. Yet Pike was intent upon documenting and proclaiming the interior, the esoteric knowledge, because he was afraid that things could happen to Freemasonry as they happened to a lot of Orthodox religion, that the esoteric goes out completely, and that a mere system of husks remains without anything in the husks. And that, of course, is also an important thing to keep in mind. Here is what he wrote, that the symbols could become, as he once wrote, like the seashells washed up from the depths, motionless and dead upon the sandy beaches of the oceans, and the symbols become as voiceless and lifeless as the shells. This was his fear. And that was one of the great reasons that he made the kind of contribution that he did. So this then is the great danger, that the outer swallows and smothers the inner. To prevent this, Pike gave his life and his considerable talents. So I think it's important to remember him and his work, and not to allow his contribution to fall into neglect. Let me, in conclusion, just read a short passage, which is actually quoted by Manly P. Hall from a tribute that was given to Pike at the time of his death. I think Mr. Hall does not identify the source here. Albert Pike was a king among men, by the divine right of merit. A giant in body, in brain, in heart, and in soul. So majestic in appearance that whenever he moved on highway or byway, the wild world over, every passerby turned to gaze upon him and admire him. 6 feet 2 inches with the proportion of a Hercules and the grace of an Apollo. A face and head massive and leonine, recalling in every feature some sculptor's dream of a Grecian god, while his long wavy hair flowing down over his shoulders added a striking picturesque effect. He was in himself the highest and grandest embodiment of the virtues and graces of Freemasonry, a living exemplification of the exalted and exalting principles of your great world-embracing brotherhood. He ran the whole gamut of earthly honors, he climbed fame's glittering ladder to its loftiest height, and stepped from its topmost round into the skies. Again, lovely 19th century writing. And so I think, as some of us, as Freemasons, Hiram's traveling men, and some of us just as Americans, I think we all can be proud and reverential of this truly great and unusual man who became the apostle of esotericism to Freemasonry and through that to America, and whose contribution and whose basic insights and recognitions should never be allowed to fall into forgetfulness, should never be allowed to die. And maybe if we contributed a little bit to that possibility, then we have come here together for a good purpose. Thank you very much.
Copyright MND III by BC Recordings, catalog number 301406. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit Gnosis.org, that's GNOSIS.org.